Little trigger warning, y'all. This episode deals heavily with two things that might freak some of you guys out. Semen and homunculus is. Homunculi?
Yeah.
Semen and the plural of homunculus. And so if those things trigger you in some way, if the little men freak you out, do not listen.
And by semen, we're not talking about sailing.
No, we're talking about cum. We're talking about splooge. We're talking about load. We're talking about all these different kinds of things, but we are hopefully dealing with it in a way that brings a little bit of dignity to the most undignified practice of all, which is ejaculation. All right, ladies and gentlemen, the time has come. My name is Brace Belden.
I'm producer Young Chomsky.
And this is TruAnon. And it struck me on the way to the studio today that this might be, subconsciously, a producer-style event, these episodes that are coming up, to make shows so wretched and unpalatable that Liz is forced to return to the program.
Oh, I see. That's clever.
Yeah. Well, I don't think that I did it on purpose, but I was going over my notes this morning.
So you're Max Bialystock?
I've never seen the producers. I just know what happens.
I think I'm more of a Bialystock and you're Leo Bloom.
Well, I'm whatever one had the idea because okay. It's a subconscious thing. I think that's Leo, right? I've really only seen it in the Curb Your Enthusiasm when he does it in that. But I got to tell you, this is going to be a difficult pair of episodes to listen to for many of our listeners for many different reasons. I have done nothing, literally nothing, except for work on this the past several days. We are front-loading some episodes right now because we are going on a little break. And unfortunately, I picked the biggest topic I think I could possibly pick, but it didn't start out that way.
As is your wont.
I know. It started out very small. I thought I was going to do a goofy little episode about a sort of strange practice that happens in a faraway land. And I realized that actually the history is quite expansive and goes back, in fact, to the beginning. We're not going to go all the way back to the beginning, but we're going to go back pretty far. Ladies and gentlemen, I have sacrificed my health, sanity, and I think something ineffable but irretrievable that belongs somewhere in my gonadal area while researching these episodes and writing these notes out. I have sacrificed a great deal of my brain power, such as it is, and you know, you write these things, you read these things, and you hope that little of it, sticks in your memory for that long. And unfortunately, I have a feeling that much of this will stick in my memory for the rest of my life. Time to begin. You are a 23-year-old reservist in the IDF called up in 2024 to fight in the Gaza Strip. Your name is Uri. Your family is from Ashkelon, originally Poland. You are a bulldozer driver. Your job is to bulldoze houses. You aren't particularly concerned about who lived in those houses, though you feel a sort of enmity towards them. They are terrorists, after all, and the IDF bulldozes terrorists' houses. A single 5.56 bullet penetrates your belly. It twists your insides. You cough up blood. You can't believe it. A bullet is crazy. You think of your wife, Lufa. Your comrades remove you from the hole that you've fallen in. You've lost a lot of blood. You feel faint. Having run out of morphine, they give you MDMA, and you drift off slowly. You perish in ecstatic confusion. Your body is flown to one of four hospitals in Israel. Doctors will drain your balls of semen at the request of your parents. Several years later, you may find yourself, after death, a father. This episode was created after reading about the so-called sperm retrieval units of the IDF, which don't technically exist, although the sperm retrieval practice does, and to figure out why this happens at all and why it happens pretty much only in Israel. We'll be going on a long journey together through darkness and light, through God and Santos Traficante, Prohibition and the Sexual Revolution. We are going to figure out why Israeli soldiers get their balls drained after they get shot and killed. All right, let's start with Genesis. This is from Genesis 38. Hit me with this.
Now it came about at that time that Judah was demoted by his brothers, and he turned away until he came to an Adullamite man named Hirah. And there Judah saw the daughter of a merchant named Shua, and he took her and came to her. And she conceived and bore a son, and he named him Ur. And she conceived again and bore a son, and she named him Onan. Once again she bore a son, and she named him Shelah, and he, Judah, was in Chezib when she gave birth to him. And Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn, named Tamar. Now Ur, Judah's firstborn, was evil in the eyes of the Lord, and the Lord put him to death. So Judah said to Onan, "Come to your brother's wife, and perform the rite of the levirate, and raise up progeny for your brother." Now Onan knew that the progeny would not be his, and it came about, when he came to his brother's wife, he wasted his semen on the ground, in order not to give seed to his brother. Now what he did was evil in the eyes of the Lord, and he put him to death also.
Okay, you're familiar with this story, right?
I'm familiar with Onan and his namesake practice.
Yeah, well, that's where it comes from.
Yes.
This is a rather famous Bible story, and the basis for not only a lot of Jewish law, but the Christians seem to like this practice quite a bit as well. Before I, you know, really get into this here, I'm going to be honest. I'm a amateur student of religion, mm-hmm. right? I'm reading these books. I'm believing every word,
right.
But I'm not overly familiar with some of these texts. I had, I think, absorbed through pop culture that, okay, this is sort of the basis of the prohibition against masturbation, although I don't quite see a lot of masturbating going on in this. All right, we need to establish some ground facts here. First, why was Onan supposed to marry his dead brother's wife? What if he thought she was perhaps nasty or weird? What if they didn't vibe sexually? Well, he was still expected to make love to and marry her, due to a practice known as a levirate marriage, where if you die married and childless, your brother is supposed to marry your wife. So this is actually from Deuteronomy.
If brothers reside together and one of them dies childless, the dead man's wife shall not marry an outsider. Her husband's brother must come to her, taking her as his wife in a levirate marriage. The firstborn son whom she bears will then perpetuate the name of the dead brother, so that his name will not be obliterated from Israel.
You know, I seem to recall a lot of the press making fun of Hunter Biden yeah. for having sexual relations and perhaps smoking a little bit of crack with his dead brother's wife pretty much immediately after his brother Beau did die. But perhaps he was fulfilling these ancient practices. So this is also known in Judaism as Yibum. Here's the thing, though. And the reality is, it's contradict. The next part of Deuteronomy is like, you actually don't have to do this. Like, if you don't want to fuck your dead brother's wife, you just got to do this like ceremony and you're good. It is essentially not practiced at all in modern day Judaism, except I did talk to a rabbi this morning, very grateful for his help. And he said that I would have made a great yeshiva student.
Oh.
That one like small sect still does practice this, I think, of Yemeni Jews, but pretty much nobody else does and hasn't for a long time. The thing is, though, all right, it seems like it's commanded here in Deuteronomy. So it's like, okay, well, he broke one of these things. But Deuteronomy was given to Moses in the Sinai, no?
That sounds right.
That happens after this.
Okay.
So what exactly is going on here? Like, why is he in so much trouble? Did he know, like, wasn't necessarily a commandment from the Lord. It's strange. Why was Onan put to death? He did have sex with his dead brother's wife, Tamar, in an unorthodox way, as in without the aim of procreation, right?
Yeah.
He spilled, or I think in Hebrew, it's literally he destroyed his seed, wasting it. I always pictured, from the way it's written here, that he essentially did the pull-out method. He was like, oh, we're going to fulfill our obligations. Let's make a little love. I know it's a bit awkward. You know, you're my brother's dad. Well, yeah, he died. But God put him to death. I'm here. Let's make love. And then at the last second, he's like, yeah, I don't feel like it, and pulls out.
Sort of a reverse stealth maneuver.
Exactly. It is a stealth maneuver,
yeah.
But it's just not done in the colloquial sense that it's generally known. So there's actually a great deal of Talmudic debate on what actually went on here. And I spent significantly too much time reading it. I never really read the Talmud before. It is a very fascinating set of texts.
Gonna be spending more time on that?
Yeah, I think I might. Well, if I have any questions about any stuff in here, I think it is a good thing to consult. So the question is, did Onan simply do the pull-out method and deceive Tamar? Did he stealth her and have sex with her, like, while secretly knowing, like, I'm actually not going to reproduce with you when I do this? Or did he have sex in an unorthodox way? And there's a great deal of reference to anal sex within the Talmudic debates on that issue. Because here's the deal with anal sex, and sorry to our gay listeners out there, or really our people who just enjoy anal sex.
Sure.
You can't have a baby with that. You know? Famously, you can't have a baby. And so there's all these rabbis kind of going back and forth, like, well, did he have anal sex with her? Or what did he do here? Some rabbis in the Talmud say, okay, he did have anal sex. But we actually know one thing for certain. He had sex with her without meaning to procreate, and he did it on purpose. Mm. But the question is, why did God kill his brother Ur in the first place?
Right.
So let's speculate, perhaps with some evidence. First of all, why was Ur put to death? And again, much like Onan, there is some Talmudic debate about this subject. Some of this hinges on the word also being used to describe Onan's death. The Talmud states that it is likely that Ur and Onan alike had sex with Tamar in a manner, let's say, not quite usual. Again, this manner is often translated to anal sex. Rav Naham Bar Yitzhak, a Babylonian rabbi of the 3rd century, says that he's pretty sure that this is what happened. Ur was simply way too into anal sex. So, he was killed for that? That also, a lot of these rabbis say, seems to imply that he was because, you know, it's linking him to his brother. Perhaps they died for the same reason. Now, I gotta tell you, I'm not a rabbi. I'm not a Talmudic scholar. I've never done any sort of Jewish education in my life. And so perhaps there is some further subtext that I am missing here. But it seems like the also means that just also this guy was put to death rather than he was put to death also for having anal sex.
An Old Testament God was like, at the drop of a hat.
More butt fucking. This is the deal. You guys are lucky, you Christians, that you made a new compact with him. You Muslims are lucky that you had another prophet come. Because our God, apparently, will individually kill you for having anal sex with your wife. And there weren't even that many people back then.
Right.
However, I do not believe, actually, that this is what happened. So, Onan's sin, okay. Let's say his sin is that he pulls out and does not wish to procreate with his wife, or he doesn't wish to procreate his wife, but he destroys his seed. He flings it upon the ground so that his wife will not get pregnant. Is that the sin? Is pulling out from a woman the sin? Is coming on the ground a sin? Or is violating levirate marriage the sin there? So he wasn't necessarily put to death. This is my reading. Again, not a Talmudic scholar here, but there are some scholars that agree with me. He wasn't necessarily put to death for busting a nut upon the bare earth. He was put to death for emitting inappropriately, yes, but within the context of this marriage.
Right.
So this leads to a great deal more Talmudic debate. So this is from Nida 13a. I think Nida mostly deals with women's cleanliness practices. Obviously, Judaism had at that period, and still does in some, I guess, let's say more orthodox variations, have a lot to do with like ritual purity and becoming impure from various things. So there's quite a lot of ink spilled about periods in this, but we cover masturbation a little bit within the Talmud. So
the Gemara asks, and why must one refrain to that extent from holding his penis? because as the result of holding his penis, he might emit semen for naught. As Rabbi Yohanan says, anyone who emits semen for naught is liable to receive the punishment of death at the hand of heaven, as it is stated with regard to Onan, son of Judah. And it came to pass, when he engaged in intercourse with his brother's wife, that he spilled it on the ground, lest he should give seed to his brother. And the thing that he did was evil in the eyes of the Lord, and he slew him also. Genesis 38, 9 through 10.
Semen for naught. Spilled on the ground, wasted. Being sucked up by the same dirt that one day, I don't know what, we'll make a golem out of. There's a great deal more argumentation in the Talmud about Onan's transgression. This is from Nida 13b.
Rav says, one who intentionally causes himself an erection shall be ostracized. The Gemara suggests, and let Rav say simply that it is prohibited. The Gemara explains that it is proper to ostracize such a man, as he arouses the evil inclination upon himself. And Rabbi Ami says, he is called a habitual transgressor, as this is the craft of the evil inclination.
So it's like there's all these arguments there. And some people are like, within the Talmud, they're like, if you jack off or if you jack off too much, we gotta cut off your hand. And then other rabbis are like, we don't have to cut off the whole hand. Can't we just say we're going to cut off the hand like it's a curse, but we don't actually cut off the hand? And then other rabbis are like, well, no, we got to cut off the hand, but here's the deal. What if at the last minute he puts his hand over his belly, and so we cut off his hand, but we also slice into his belly? Now we have, like, fucked the entire punishment up, and did we become impure? And so there's a great deal of these sort of, I don't think that they had a lot to do in those days. And I really would like to see, I mean, I don't know, I'm not a scholar, you know, maybe there were some guys walking around in, you know, in Jerusalem and in, you know, in the year BC 5 or whatever. And, you know, you got one hand and you see another guy with a hand and you do the nod to him because you think that he's a thief because you got your hand cut off because you're a thief. And then he sort of casts his eyes away in shame and you know that is a handless masturbator. He simply could not stop masturbating.
Yeah, I'd be walking around with no hands.
Well, here's the deal. These practices are a little, they've remained with us a little bit. Now, obviously, Judaism is pretty much unrecognizable from ancient times as it is today. But who are Orthodox? They still sort of practice certain things from this, let's say. Now, one of the debates in the Talmud is, can you hold your wiener while peeing? And there is a great deal of ink spilled on this issue as well. Some rabbis say, no, you simply hold the bottom of the testicles.
Huh.
Which I tried to do while peeing yesterday. It didn't really help me pee.
I don't think Yeah,
it didn't really help me pee. Others say you hold your penis with a cloth, but not too good of a cloth because it can make you horny, and that's when you're peeing. So actually today, there are a lot of Hasidic Jews who do pee with a sort of rough cloth holding their penis.
Wow.
So I tell you this, you're ever walking around South Williamsburg, you got a really sweaty forehead, do not ask that portly man on the flip phone if you can borrow his handkerchief to wipe your sweat off.
Because the penis cloth.
Exactly. That is going to be the penis cloth. So, all right, let's hit Leviticus here. This is from Leviticus 15:16.
The Lord said to Moses and Aaron, speak to the Israelites and say to them, when any man has an unusual bodily discharge, such a discharge is unclean. Whether it continues flowing from his body or is blocked, it will make him unclean. This is how his discharge will bring about uncleanliness. Any bed the man with a discharge lies on will be unclean, and anything he sits on will be unclean. Anyone who touches his bed must wash their clothes and bathe with water, and they will be unclean till evening. Whoever sits on anything that the man with a discharge sat on must wash their clothes and bathe with water, and they will be unclean till evening.
So next time you do your funky little jerk off at home, for the rest of the day, every bus seat that you sit upon, every bar stool that you're perched on, you are making unclean. And all those other innocent people who are following in your footsteps, unknowingly sitting in those seats, are being made unclean as well. So as you can imagine, there's quite a bit of, let's say, psychology going on with certain young religious Jews around the issue of masturbation.
This is like, this was like COVID or something. It's very rapidly.
Exactly. It's
super contagious.
There's certainly super spreaders out there. Yeah. And you know, there was a lot of debate around what exactly should be done about the masturbators. I sort of mentioned that with the cutting off the hand. What should be done about, is it okay for a person to touch his penis for any reason? The sources kind of vary on whether it is or not. And again, most of this stuff is just not followed in Judaism. I mean, Judaism has gone through many variations. Some of this stuff still informs things that are followed in Judaism, which is what we're going to be talking a little bit about today. So here's the deal. This is the second part of Deuteronomy.
If brothers are living together and one of them dies without a son, his widow must not marry outside the family. Her husband's brother shall take her and marry her and fulfill the duty of a brother-in-law to her. The first son she bears shall carry on the name of the dead brother so that his name will not be blotted out from Israel. However, if a man does not want to marry his brother's wife, she shall go to the elders at the town gate and say, "My husband's brother refuses to carry on his brother's name in Israel. He will not fulfill the duty of a brother-in-law to me." Then the elders of his town shall summon him and talk to him. If he persists in saying, "I do not want to marry her," his brother's widow shall go up to him in the presence of the elders, take off one of his sandals, spit in his face, and say, "This is what is done to the man who will not build up his brother's family line." That man's line shall be known in Israel as the family of the unsandaled.
And here's the deal. If this actually does happen to you, if your brother's wife dies and you are unmarried and you refuse to marry her, this technically, some version of this, if you're a religious Jew, can happen, which is really funny.
You don't want to be unsandaled.
You don't want to be a family of the unsandaled, known for it. But this is an important thing that we've talked about this in an early episode of the podcast. But this idea of Jewish continuity, of name continuity, looms very large for certain members of the Jewish community. But let us leave religion where it lies. We are a scientific-minded podcast, a very modern podcast. And so let us remove our priestly garb, taking care not to touch our wieners, and change into our scholar's robes. So here's a bit of a glossary. Uron.
Urine.
Logia.
The study of.
Balls.
These are dangled bags of skin that sway to and fro betwixt the hairy pillars known as legs, hanging like a criminal beneath the penile tube. They lie fore of the taint.
Testicles.
Much like how oysters contain pearls, which are made of fish sperm hardened over the centuries, testicles are white treasures within the balls. They make sperm.
Various tubes.
There are various tubes within the balls, the famous vas deferens, the hated seminiferous tubules, the mysterious rete testes. Basically, these transport or store sperm.
Sperm.
Reproductive sex cells that come from men. Singular, spermatozoon. Plural, spermatozoa.
Semen.
It is a fluid produced by an amazing process between the prostate gland and the seminal vesicles. It mixes, usually, with the sperm to sort of create a little 747 for the sperm to crash into the female's twin towers, otherwise known as an egg.
Penis.
As we all know, the wiener of the man.
Homunculus.
A tiny little man.
So, okay, you know how, like, it happens, right?
I've seen some videos.
Yeah, so sperm, it is kind of made in the balls. Mm-hmm. And it goes crazy. It like flutters around like in a centrifuge. Semen, which are the little men.
Okay.
They go in it and they sort of use that as like a protective coating where they go in. It's like a way to launch themselves into the vagina. And then they go crazy once they're in there, like, I go this way, I go that way. Like, there's a crazy race that happens, and then one single little sperm gets into the egg.
Yeah.
And hopefully fertilizes it, and a baby is made.
It fires a proton torpedo, causing a chain reaction.
Yes. You'd think this is pretty much no duh, right? Like, yeah. I mean, obviously, like, animals know this. You have to have sex, and then something has to come out, or, you know, different animals do different things. But for the most part, a lot of mammals do this kind of stuff. You blast it in, you know, and then something happens. But the ancient Greeks were like, all right, well, we get some of this. But we're like, I don't know about eggs and there's a little tiny sperm in there. I don't really know what's going to happen. I don't know what's going on with that. And they didn't think, and this is what's baffling to me. Very few of the ancient Greek philosophers were like, when they were wondering where sperm and semen came from, they didn't think, well, I wonder if it's in those strange sort of globes that hang beneath the penis.
Yeah.
No, they were like, it's come from everywhere. So Alcmaeon, a pupil of Pythagoras, believed that sperm came from the brain. Hippo thought it came from the backbone. Some scholars suggest Hippocrates thought it came from the entire body and the brain. Diocles believed it came from food and drink.
Okay.
But some scholars dispute this. Possibly Diocles believed semen came from the brain and the spine. Plato may have thought this as well. What remains without question is that few among the ancient Greeks realized that semen and sperm kind of is generated in the testicles, and it needs an egg to fertilize. And from this pairing may come a child. I mean, it's not all in the testicles, but it's, you know, that's the main part of it. So this is Aristotle from Generation of Animals.
Now, in all living things in which the male and female are not separated, the semen or seed is a sort of embryo. By embryo, I mean the first mixture of male and female. Hence, from one semen comes one body. For example, one stalk of wheat from one grain, as one animal from one egg. For twin eggs are really two eggs. But in whatever kinds the sexes are distinguished, in these, many animals may come from one emission of semen, showing that the semen differs in its nature in plants and animals. A proof of this is that animals which can bear more than one young at a time do so in consequence of only one coition, whereby, too, it is plain that the semen does not come from the whole of the body. For neither would the different parts of the semen already be separated as soon as discharged from the same part, nor could they be separated in the uterus if they had once entered it altogether. But what does happen is just what one would expect, since what the male contributes to generation is the form and the efficient cause, while the female contributes the material.
So this is kind of, I mean, this is actually rather more advanced than some of his peers. He's wrong, but a lot of these guys thought that, like, men and women basically contributed different things to the child itself. Now, that is a little bit true, but certainly not in the way that they thought. There was a lot, they didn't really know much about eggs back then. And a lot of these guys basically were like, listen, your semen contains a little guy. And then that guy is basically like, it's like a seed that's that is nurtured in the woman. And like she gives, but it was more of a philosophical way of looking at things rather than necessarily a scientific way of looking at things. Very little was done in the way of sperm and semen research after the ancient Greeks. Certainly a lot of semen was had, but people didn't really have much of a time to look quite closely at it. Some medieval scholars, and I know we're pushing up a little bit here, some medieval scholars believe that semen actually contained a homunculus, a teeny living form that exists in whole already. So picture a little sperm, little guy, right? You know? In that is a littler guy, like an actual guy is in there.
He's like piloting it.
He's like asleep. Like it's like on autopilot. It's like similar to how I believe Superman came to the America from Krypton.
Yeah.
It's sort of just sent there as a ultra baby, I guess you could call him. But he's a homunculus. So there's a lot to be said about this. We don't exactly have time for it, but Theophrastus Bombast von Hohenheim, or commonly known as Paracelsus. He's born in 1493 in a Swiss village, the son of an alchemist. He pissed everyone off all the time, hated all the universities he went to, and believed that there was possibly a homunculus in each and every load of semen shot. So this is from his De Natura Renum, or On the Nature of Things.
Let the sperm of a man by itself be putrefied in a gourd glass, sealed up with the highest degree of putrefaction and horse dung for the space of 40 days, or so long until it begins to be alive, move, and stir, which may easily be seen. After this time, it will be something like a man, yet transparent and without a body. Now, after this, if it be every day warily and prudently nourished and fed with the arcanum of man's blood, and be for the space of 40 weeks kept in a constant equal heat of horse dung, it will become a true and living infant, having all the members of an infant, which is born of a woman, but it will be far less. This we call homunculus, or artificial man. and this is afterwards to be brought up with as great care and diligence as any other infant, until it come to riper years of understanding. Now this is one of the greatest secrets that God ever made known to mortal sinful man. For this is a miracle, and one of the great wonders of God, and secret above all secrets, and deservedly it ought to be kept amongst the secrets until the last times, when nothing shall be hid, the apocalypse, but all things made manifest.
I want to make a confession here, that I got really derailed when I was writing this part of the notes out, because I got really interested in golems. Uh-huh. Because the golem, golems, people were going crazy about golems in Europe.
Well, it's a crazy...
It's crazy to do.
Yeah, if you could do
and
that.
And we don't even know how anymore.
Yeah, we forgot.
This was a... There was an alchemical sort of fad in Europe at the time. A lot of magic going around. A lot of imaginings of little guys everywhere, and you can make things. The creation of beans was like an obsession with many scholars on the continent. So the homunculus, a teeny living human being, lies within the sperm. No doubt the learned men of Europe shrugged their shoulders and said, why not? Because sperm are small. They are too small to really see with the naked eye, although the brackish gossamer fluid that they swim in could contain practically anything. Sure, when it was emitted into a vagina, a baby could come out, but again, the reigning theory was one of Aristotelian spontaneous generation. To that point, a book by von Helmont, famous for introducing the word gas to science, gives recipes for making mice out of sweaty shirts and wheat, and scorpions from bricks and basil. And this was in the early 1600s.
That's so sick.
I know.
I wish it worked that way.
But I'm like, you buy this book, and you're like, oh, dude, von Helmont's got a new fucking tome out. You're like, oh, like, dude, I can make a scorpion. Like, oh, my God. And then you get basil, probably not that hard to get, a brick. Probably not that hard to get.
Yeah.
The recipe for making scorpion is really easy. You put basil between two bricks, and I think you just leave it out in the sun. A lot of this is about leaving things out in the sun because they kind of got the idea from all of this because they believe maggots spontaneously appeared in meat.
Yeah, but a watch pot never boils, so you got to leave for a while and
that's
come
facts.
Back.
You got to go leave because when people started disproving the maggots spontaneously generating thing, there was like people got pissed. They were like, no, dude. They fucking are spontaneously there. And people be like, no, I think it's their eggs that are dropped on it. And they're like, no, it's real. But a scientific advancement will soon put to rest a lot of this. The development of the microscope.
Mm.
Later in that century changes everything. And the Dutchman, Antony van Leeuwenhoek. You know, I've read that name quite a few times over the past couple of weeks, but this is the first time I've tried to say it. Antony van Leeuwenhoek, a daring scientist, elevated the microscope to an art form. So this is from the observations of Mr. Antony Leeuwenhoek on animalcules engendered in the semen. This is from letter number 22, taken from the book Early Theories of Sexual Generation by F.J. Cole. I got to tell you, it's on Z Library. You can find it very easily, and it is a very fascinating book.
I have several times examined the same matter, human semen, from a healthy man, not from a sick man, nor spoiled by keeping for a long time, and not liquefied after the lapse of some minutes, but immediately after ejaculation, before 6 beats of the pulse had intervened. And I have seen so great a number of living creatures in it that sometimes more than 1,000 were moving about in an amount of material the size of a grain of sand. I saw this vast number of living animalcules not all through the semen, but only in the liquid matter which seemed adhering to the surface of the thicker part. In the thicker matter of the semen, however, the animalcules lay apparently motionless. And I conceive the reason of this to be that the thicker matter consisted of so many coherent particles that the animalcules could not move in it. These animalcules were smaller than the corpuscles which impart a red color to the blood, so that I judge 1,000,000 of them would not equal in size a large grain of sand. Their bodies were rounded, but blunt in front and running to a point behind, and furnished with a long, thin tail, about 5 or 6 times as long as the body, and very transparent, and with the thickness of about 1/25 that of the body, so that I can best liken them in form to a small earth nut with a long tail. The animalcules move forward with a snake-like motion of the tail, as eels do when swimming in water, and in the somewhat thicker matter, they lashed their tails some 8 or 10 times in advancing a hair's breadth. I have sometimes fancied that I could even discern different parts in the bodies of these animalcules. But for as much as I have not always been able to do so, I will say no more. Among these animalcules, there will be some still smaller particles, to which I can ascribe nothing but a globular form.
So it's interesting. He actually has some sketches of sperm that he made, which are really kind of fascinating. So animalcules is, I believe, just what he calls like little guys he sees in the microscope, because he did a lot of research on like bacteria and shit too, and he uses the word animalcules. I guess he means cells.
Sure.
I'm not a big scientifically minded person, so I don't really know what he was talking about, but animalcules is kind of his language for it.
Makes sense.
So this set off a firestorm. Everyone was like, oh my God, there's fucking little missiles in there?
Yeah.
I thought the whole thing was the missile. Elsewhere in that same letter, he says that King Charles II was like, I need to see this fucking cum. And I'm just going to quote from it. Commanded the spermatoza to be presented to him swimming and frisking in their native fluid. So that means that like Antony was like, yo, King Charles, I got to show you this cum. And Antony's, and King Charles is like, I need to see this. Who's the guy? Did you think he commanded one of his footmen? Like, yo, jerk off for Antony. I want to look at your nut.
The royal nutter.
Yeah. What are you thinking about, though? That's what I always trip out about. What are you thinking about, you know?
Not
are
God.
You thinking about, like, the ankle of a lass, you know?
Yeah.
The smell of, like, potato dirt fingers caressing your face.
Whatever like, it takes. I mean, hopefully they had, like, you know, crude drawings that they could give you. And
oh, I'm sure they did, but they probably thought women looked, you know, like dragons. Or, you know, if you'd never seen a woman before, you might think that she's like a griffin underneath her, you know, a flaxen coat or whatever. Anyways, it's an interesting time period. This is from the Embryo Project Encyclopedia, accompanies some sketches of, let's say, embryos.
This embryology image is a pencil sketch by Nicolas Hartsoker, published as part of his 1694 French language paper entitled Essai de Dioptrique, a semi-speculative work describing the sorts of new scientific observations that could be done using magnifying lenses. Dioptrique was published in Paris by the publishing house of Jean Anisson. The image depicts a curled-up infant-like human, now referred to as a homunculus, inside the head of a sperm cell. This sketch is important to embryology because it is one of the most illustrative examples of performationism, a theory of generation stating that each future member of any given species exists fully formed, though minuscule, within the genetic cells, sperm or eggs, of its parents. This theory was popular among naturalists in the 18th century.
So I bring up the homunculus stuff again here to show that actually 1694 is pretty late for this to be happening.
Yeah.
Antony's experiments with looking at the cum through a microscope happened, I believe, like a decade or two prior to this. But people were really taken with homunculuses existing. And there is a certain pattern that sort of develops. I mean, one thing this says here is that a preformationism, a theory of generation stating that each future member of any given species exists fully formed, though minuscule, within the gametic cells of its parents. So that means like all of your, like you within your testicles and within, you know, the woman's egg exists a bunch of little guys.
Yeah.
And it's, there's a kind of a theory that some Kabbalistic types thought of during a particular psychedelic moment in Judaism, which is that there's a great well of souls, I think called the Guf, where every Jewish soul already exists. And so by jerking off and nutting on the ground, as Onan did, you're actually like expelling Jewish souls onto the ground to be trampled underfoot. Not too dissimilar from this idea that our testicles contain like billions or millions of little men, and that by ejaculating on the ground, we condemn these tiny little, you know, who are the fellas that that messed with Gulliver? Lilliputians.
Yes.
These sort of Lilliputians nestled within our sperm are condemned to death, and to starve on the ground. There's a lot of action after this, though. Science does advance, and we don't actually have time for all of it. There's a few things I'd like to point out. 1799, Lazzaro Spallanzini proves that babies come from sperm because he fertilizes an egg. And he sees, okay, this is what happens here. Like, he actually sees the process happen. He also famously put tight pants on frogs to show that spontaneous generation doesn't happen.
I see.
It's very strange. People were really, you know what? They didn't know much back then. Because I was thinking while I was researching this, I'm like, when did they actually figure out in the modern way that we know things how babies are made? Uh-huh. And you'd be shocked that it's actually not that long ago.
Well, coming up with the scientific method was pretty significant.
Yes.
Like, well, we can control, do an experiment.
Yes, that was a pretty significant advance. Yeah, and like helped. People knew that if you had sex with somebody and you ejaculated in them, that was going to probably lead to a baby. But they didn't really know how exactly that happened. And there was a lot of ideas. 1843, Martin Barry sees a sperm entering a rabbit's egg and he flips out. In 1866, actually forgot to write the guy's name down, but there is a, I believe an Italian scientist drops some sperm in a vial in the snow and then finds that the sperm actually was still alive when he brought it back to the laboratory.
Wow.
Whereas it probably should not have been. In 1876, a German zoologist named Oscar Hertwig figures it out. He says a single sperm penetrates an egg and a woman becomes pregnant. Fidel Castro was born on August 13th, 1926. He fathered 9 children in his life. Fulgencio Batista was born on January 16th, 1901. He fathered 9 children in his life. According to his prison file, Norman Rothman was born in 1914 in Brooklyn, New York. And according to a 1967 FBI report, he was the son of Leon Rothman from the great country of Romania, which in the late 1800s and early 20th century was not a nice place to be a Jew. He fathered 3 children with 1 woman and 1 child with another. All boys. 1914, Norman Rothman is born. But that's also the year that the Great War kicks off. This is going to be, and everyone was saying, guys, we're going to do a world war right now because with advances due to communication and ease of travel, we can finally kind of get really one of these going.
Yeah.
But this is going to be the last one. We have to make this the war to end all wars. Everybody get it out of your system right now. Any kind of territorial ambitions, any enemies you have, kill them now because we're never going to do this again because it's going to suck so bad.
Right.
The following is an excerpt from the Medical Department of the United States Army in the World War, Volume 11, Surgery, Part 1. The report was prepared by Major Hugh Young, who would later found the Journal of Urology. An award in his honor would later be given to John K. Lattimore, RFK's urologist, who would be given access by the family in order to examine the facts around the JFK assassination. I know that's a bit much, but this is from a report on casualties in World War I.
Wounds of the external genitalia. Gunshot wounds of the external genitalia occurred in the American Expeditionary Forces as follows. Penis, 171. Scrotum, 499. Testicle, 237. In a series of 42 cases of injury to the penis involving the penile urethra or the penis alone, rifle and machine gun missiles were the cause of 27. Shrapnel and high explosive shell, 14, indirect injury, 1. The entrance wound involved the penis in 29 instances, the thigh in 9, buttock, 1, hip, 1, abdomen, 1. Secondary injuries numbered 20. In a series of 164 cases of injury to the scrotum and testicles, 95 of the wounds were due to rifle or machine gun missiles, 58 to shrapnel and high explosive shells, 5 to grenade fragments, 2 to revolver missiles. In 83 cases of scrotal injury, the testicles were not involved, or at least not sufficiently involved to require operative treatment. There were 81 cases in which injury to the testicles was recorded, necessitating a right orchidectomy in 31 instances, a left orchidectomy 23 times, and a bilateral orchidectomy twice. Among the 81 cases with testicular injury, there were 10 deaths, but among the 83 cases in which the scrotum was involved, 5 deaths occurred.
I want to say right now that it is actually really difficult to find ball and penis injuries from World War II.
Hmm.
I looked for like an hour yesterday, and I was like, you know, I'm in Internet Archive, like looking through these, like I'm on Z Library. I'm literally just searching keywords and shit right there, looking at papers. There are individual reports from like specific hospitals, but this is actually, it's interesting. This is a totalizing report from World War One that is far more comprehensive than anything I could find from World War Two. And I maybe just couldn't find it, but it really seems difficult.
Why do you think that might be?
I have no idea. It's strange because you would think there would be like a great deal more recording. Maybe it's there's more casualties. I mean, we were in World War II for that long either, but we were only in World War I for like less than a year.
Yeah.
I got to tell you though, if you're on that World War I for less than a year and you're one of the two guys who got his nuts blown off with a revolver fighting, boy, oh boy, not so good.
Bad luck.
There's a lot to say about World War I and fertility. That is probably maybe for another episode that has to do with other things because we don't have room here. And Norman Rothman didn't really give a fuck about all that either because he was a baby. World War I ends on June 28th, 1919 with the signing of the Treaty of Versailles. Adolf Hitler, a young corporal, finds himself without much to do. Years later, this song will be written about him.
Hitler has only got one bone, Goering has two but very small. Hitler has something similar.
That same year of 1919, several underpaid members of the Chicago White Sox make a deal with some gambling and underworld figures to fix the World Series. The White Sox lose the series on October 9th, 1919. The money was rumored to be put up by the Jewish gambler Arnold Rothstein. Early days of 1920, alcohol was banned in the United States of America in what came to be known as Prohibition. Later that year, Arnold Rothstein attends a bar mitzvah, where he meets a young, up-and-coming, enterprising man named Meyer Lansky. In 1922, the UK takes a survey of the population of Mandatory Palestine. There are 580,890 Muslims, 83,794 Jews, 73,024 Christians, and 9,474 others. Norman Rothman drops out of school in eighth grade. He lies about his age to get a job at F.W. Woolworth Company. One imagines in 1928, when he is 14 years old, he might have opened the Brooklyn Eagle to read the headline, "Gamblers Hunted as Rothstein Lies at the Point of Death."
George Hump McManus, reputed to be one of Broadway's best-known floating gamblers, and several other men are being sought by the police this afternoon for questioning in connection with the shooting last night of Arnold Rothstein, nationally known gambler and sportsman. The police say they have established definitely that the shooting occurred in room 349 of the Park Central Hotel, Manhattan. They suspect that McManus and the others being sought were present at the time. They also are certain that Rothstein knows who shot him and why. But the gambler, lying at the point of death in Polyclinic Hospital, is keeping his lips sealed. At the hospital with Rothstein are his wife, his brother, and his father.
Well, to Mr. Arnold Rothstein's brother, you know what to do with the wife after this, don't
you? Of course.
There's a great book called King of the Jews by Nick Tosh about Rothstein, which we will not be quoting from today because my copy was too high on the bookshelf and I did not want to get a little stepladder out. Meyer Lansky was 26 years old at this point. He was making a good deal of money from bootlegging. But then the Great Depression hits. It's difficult. Norman Rothman takes various construction jobs, including helping build the famous Radio City Music Hall. This is an excerpt from Norman Rothman's son Cappy's autobiography.
Rothman eventually took a job with the Russoff Construction Company, which specialized in subway construction and infrastructure. He labored on sewer lines in Manhattan and worked on building the New York City subway's 6th Avenue line. Severe headaches and a case of the bends contracted while working underground, however, moved Rothman above ground and into more supervisory roles. It was around then, according to notes for an intended autobiography Rothman began compiling while in prison, that the young man became, quote, interested in the union cause, unquote, and helped organize laborers working on the 6th Avenue line. He must have been effective, because after the subway opened in 1936, Russoff transferred Rothman to upstate New York, where he took the role of head timekeeper for field operations, a job that called for him to be the company's union liaison.
I just want to be clear on what the quotes around interested in the union cause might mean here. I mean, 1920s, 1930s, 1940s, anybody with sort of a cursory knowledge of organized crime in New York City will see that actually it is a tale of, at least relative to the mores of the time, rather progressive in terms of the racial makeup of organized crime, because you saw a lot of Jewish mobsters and a lot of Italian mobsters making common cause.
Hmm, now, beautiful.
Norman here is Jewish, but it does appear that perhaps maybe through some of this work, he becomes closer and is rumored, at least according to his son, to be possible, and to the FBI at points, to be part of La Cosa Nostra. And okay, as for him working as this union guy, as this construction worker, well, I was looking at an FBI report from 1974 that describes him making his living as a bookmaker in New York during the 1930s. Perhaps this is just a side job. And a 1961 CIA report has him telling the FBI, Mr. Rothman, that he was arrested for bookmaking and violation of prohibition laws during this period. But the FBI doesn't seem to have these records.
Hmm.
Nevertheless, in 1933, liquor is legalized in the United States of America, but it has cemented the mafia and the Jewish mafia as, let's say, a prominent force in certain American cities. That same year of 1933, a young sergeant named Fulgencio Batista participates in a revolt at an army base in the small country of Cuba. President Machado was out. Batista, however, was not officially in charge. The revolutionary upheaval finds the young officer like he was in a dream of some sort, now the Cuban Army Chief of Staff. Batista serves behind a series of puppet presidents, and he learns he likes being in charge. Meyer Lansky, who has expanded some of his alcohol, winnings to get into the gambling business, meets Batista. And according to author Jack Calhoun, they organize a deal for molasses. Now, Calhoun puts this meeting in 1933, but the revolt of the sergeants that Batista participates in happens like at the end of 1933, so I don't think that date can really be correct there, but it seemingly is pretty early. That's the first earliest meeting, it would certainly the earliest possible meeting, between Lansky and Batista. I don't know if it actually happened, because I don't believe he even has a footnote for that one. But there's a lot of talk about them meeting fairly early on, before Batista was officially the president. In 1936, Batista loosens the laws around gambling in Cuba, and Meyer Lansky pays him a visit. He leaves with a stake in the Hotel Nacional. 4 years later, in 1940, Batista was elected president of Cuba. World War II begins in 1939. That grumbling little corporal, Adolf Hitler, causes a catastrophe for Europe and the world. The Nazi regime sterilizes 400,000 undesirables. 6 million Jews and millions of other minorities are killed in concentration camps and in roundups. Tens of millions of soldiers and ordinary citizens die in the war. Europe is devastated. But not Norman Rothman. Norman Rothman was drafted into the U.S. Army, yes, in 1945. And this was unusual because he was 30 years old. And what's more unusual is that he was actually discharged early, after only 8 months. His son does seem to believe that possibly some of his contacts from his years as a union man might have helped this process along.
Hmm.
The Anglo-American Committee was formed in 1945 with the aim of solving the Jewish question in Europe. The diaspora had been negated. The Zionist movement emerges victorious from the Holocaust. Thousands of Jews leave Europe for the British Mandate of Palestine. In 1946, Meyer Lansky hosts a conference for various personalities in the American and international mafia at the Hotel Nacional in Cuba. In 1947, Israel declares independence. Some arms come from the Czechs, facilitated by Robert Maxwell and, shamefully, Joseph Stalin. But Yehuda Arazi, a secret agent for the Haganah, is dispatched to New York City. From an article in Tablet magazine describing U.S. Jewish mafia support for the Haganah.
At this time, the U.S. government maintained an arms embargo against Israel and the Middle East. But Egypt and the Arab countries managed to avoid the embargo and get weapons. Arazi learned that the mafia controlled the port of New York, and he had no scruples about contacting underworld figures. he approached Meyer Lansky and asked him to help get weapons loaded onto ships bound for Israel. Lansky said he would handle it. Lansky contacted Albert Anastasia and Joe Adonis, who controlled the Longshoremen's Union and the docks. They helped Israeli agents conceal the arms purchased for Israel, while arms bound for Egypt mysteriously fell overboard. Illegal consignments of military hardware, some of it brand new and still packed in oil and straw, were then secreted onto ships that happened to be bound for Israel.
By 1947, Norman Rothman was bound for Miami. That same year, 1947, in that same town, Miami, the syphilis-ridden Al Capone's brain explodes. His son, also named Al Capone, would change his name to Albert Francis Brown and live a quiet life in California. No matter. Elsewhere in Miami, South Beach, to be precise, a different liquid was being spilled. Liquor! Into glasses in the beautiful bar at the architectural wonder known as the Albion Hotel. And who should be the business manager of this wonderful place but Norman Rothman? Miami is booming in those days, and there are a lot of very friendly people in town. Rothman makes friends with the Manarino brothers, gangsters from Pittsburgh. He meets a man named Santos Traficante Jr., the nepo baby of his father, Santos Traficante Sr. Both Traficantes have cultivated many connections in the country of Cuba. Norman Rothman is arrested again, either for vagrancy or bookmaking. The sources vary. At some point, he earns the nickname Rough House. Norman's firstborn son, Cappy, was bristling at his father, who might be a party guy at work but was quite stern at home. He's shipped off to military school. And we'll see you later, Cappy. His father had some ideas. It's 1948, and he heads to Cuba, where he sees the beautiful Sans Sushi nightclub. His friends, the Manarino brothers, like the sound of owning this joint, and they buy it and install Norman as the manager. Batista, no longer president, runs for the Cuban Senate and wins. At this point, he's splitting his time between the Waldorf Astoria in New York and Daytona Beach. Israel, newly founded, is at war with the Arab League. The latter's disorganized forces lead to a horrific defeat. There is mass ethnic cleansing of Arabs, known as the Nakba. 800,000 are displaced. Jews become the majority in what becomes known as Israel. 45% of the 1947 population in UN-designated Israeli land was Arab. 4 years later, 1951, it was 11%. This is from Principles and Applications of Cryopreservation.
A decisive breakthrough came in 1949 when British scientist Christopher Polge discovered the cryoprotective properties of glycerol for germplasm, an event widely regarded as the first recognized report of successful cryopreservation. Polge initially intended to increase the viscosity of sperm samples using glycerol, but an experimental error led him to freeze a glycerol-containing sample instead. Upon thawing, he observed that the sperm exhibited no freezing-induced damage, revealing glycerol's unexpected protective effect against ice crystal formulation.
So you understand what he's saying there, right?
Sure, that they reanimated.
Exactly. They can freeze sperm without fucking the sperm up with freezer burn.
Mm.
Israel opens its border to any Jew who wants to move there in what is known as Aliyah. The devastation of European Jewry means that Mizrahi and Haredim are actually sought out and brought to the country. The 1950s are good for the mafia. They're not wonderful for the Cubans. Batista runs for president again, but decides that he doesn't like to gamble so much and seizes control of the country using the military. The games at the casinos of Cuba are not exactly fair. In 1952, just before Nixon decides to run for vice president, a friend of his named Dana Smith, who is in fact one of Nixon's major fundraisers, was gambling in Havana at the Sans Sushi, managed by Norman Rothman. He loses $4,200. These things happen. Rothman says he'll be happy to take a check. A perhaps drunken Smith writes one out, and when he sobers up, he cancels it. Rothman sues Smith. Rothman loses. Havana's gambling reputation nosedives. The games are fixed. And that reputation isn't good for anybody. In 1954, we see the famous headline in the Cedar Rapids Gazette, "Fatherhood after death has now proved possible."
Iowa City, the history-making birth of the first normal babies resulting from conception by means of stored frozen semen has taken place, according to informed sources here. Although University of Iowa scientists refuse to comment on their study, which has made medical history, it is known that three infants have been born. Authorities would not reveal whether the offspring were male or female or other details concerning the births. The infants are the first in history to be born by means of frozen spermatozoa. In December, Drs. J.K. Sherman and R.G. Bung of the SUI Urology Department, who have been instrumental in the project, announced that births were to be expected in December, January, and February.
Dr. Sherman, I found out, was known to his students as Sperman Sherman.
Sick.
Cuba is looking better and better to the American mafia. Meyer Lansky gets himself hired as a gambling advisor by the Batista government. He buys into several casinos, as do many of his associates. Enforcers of various stripes prowl the streets of Havana. In the pages of the newspaper Granma, many years later, Julio Molina describes Batista's men.
They were, quote, men of base instincts, born criminals, beasts carrying all the ancestral atavisms dressed in human form, unquote, to put it in Fidel's words, who put the nation on edge and, especially, its youth, who died with their eyes gouged out, without nails, their testicles burst or raped in barracks, ditches, wastelands, rivers, seas.
In 1953, Fidel and Raul Castro, along with dozens of their men, attack the Moncada barracks. They fail and are killed or arrested. In 1955, Batista passes Hotel Law 2074, which automatically grants a casino license to any hotel that costs over $1 million to build. The mafia build the Hotel Capri. It's owned by Santos Traficante Jr. From Cappy Rothman's autobiography.
Being the oldest and favored son of Norman Rothman had its privileges. As a young man, Cappy Rothman befriended Batista's son, Jorge, and would occasionally go with his father to meet the boss, Santo Traficante Jr., in Miami. When he was a little older, in the days before the Batista regime came crashing down in 59, when Cappy was 21, his visits to Cuba included raucous nights of partying with the sons of the political, cultural, and gangsterismo elite. He earned the nickname Flaca for his preference for slender women, while his Cuban friends preferred culas grandes, big butts.
There was rampant prostitution in Cuba. The people were very poor. Cappy's father decides that maybe that nice Jewish girl from New York that he married isn't enough, and he enters into a second marriage in Cuba, the same time as his first. I don't know what kind of levirate marriage that is. This one is to a showgirl named Olga Chaviano, a beautiful Afro-Cuban woman. They have a child together, Faustino Chaviano, who, some reports I read, later died of HIV. But Cappy is at military school, and he only sees his father's life sometimes. The year is 1955, and things were overall going very well. Cappy Rothman actually graduates that year from Valley Forge Military Academy and heads to the University of Miami. He joins the ROTC. Meanwhile, the Manarino brothers, the Pittsburgh Mafia guys, aren't having much fun in Cuba. They're getting a little pissed off with how much is getting skimmed by Batista. They sell the Sansucci to Santos Traficante, but Rothman, Norman, is kept on as manager. A little while later, on a quiet stretch of coast in a different part of Cuba, far from Havana, bearded revolutionaries land via a yacht named, of all things, Granma. Soon after, they were ambushed, and most of them were killed. From an FBI document in 1957.
Pittsburgh letter to director, FBI, dated 4-3-57 and captioned 11-UNSUB. Theft of $250,000 jewelry from Martin Lair, Arlington Hotel, Hot Springs, Arkansas. On page 29, mentions a Norman Rothman as setting up slot machines in Havana.
Various sources say that Rothman either brought slot machines to Cuba for the first time, or that he actually had he got the money from all slot machines outside of the city of Havana. Regardless of exactly the deal there, he was making a lot of money from slot machines in Cuba. And meanwhile in Miami, Cappy Rothman, his eldest son, is having an amazing time in college. He has a nice car, plenty of friends, lots of girls. On October 14th, 1958, the National Guard Armory in Canton, Ohio is robbed. This is from an FBI report documenting some of their investigation into this.
On November 12th, 1958, Mario Guerrieri, Youngstown, Ohio, protect identity, advised S.A. Dowds that he considered Phil Maynor, Youngstown hoodlum, a suspect in instant case. He stated he has been hanging around Canton, Ohio, with a man known only to him as Fluffy, Floof, and has been driving a 1958 Cadillac, light tan in color, as well as a light gray Chevrolet Impala owned by the same man. He later identified this person on December 2nd, 1958, as George M. Floria. He stated that he and Ronnie Carabia, Youngstown and Struthers hoodlum, had been hanging out at the Ritz Bar, Canton, Ohio, which is run by a man called Suitcase Sam.
What basically happened here is the mafia descended on Canton, Ohio, and robbed a National Guard armory there. Now, it doesn't appear that it was a strong-arm robbery, and a lot of sources writing about it say that they must have had a man on the inside, because it appears that they just walked into the National Guard armory and took a bunch of guns and walked out. On November 19th, a Beechcraft airplane takes off from West Deer, Pennsylvania. It contains burlap bags filled with 50-caliber machine guns and M1 rifles. Norman Rothman and several associates of the Manorino brothers are arrested when it lands. The FBI is confused. Later, they come to the conclusion that these guns were meant to go to Fidel Castro in order to curry favor once he took over. And there's some, like, reporting on that from FBI files that I've been able to find. It's weird. So the Manorino brothers and Norman Rothman actually do another trick with some stolen bonds in Canada. That's a whole other... We could do a whole episode about that. It's one of the biggest bank heists in history. One of the guys who does the heist is like the... He's a Corsican heroin trafficker, like the biggest heroin trafficker in Canada. It's like a job that is contracted from the United States Mafia to like the mafia in Canada, because they're like, we need guns. The Canadian mafia apparently was like, well, we don't have guns, but we can buy some guns if we rob this bank and sell all the securities from this. Huh. Doesn't make a lot of sense. Yeah. The securities, these episodes could be about 10 hours longer with like a saga of these stolen securities sort of popping up over and over and over again. And if you are somebody who is looking for a book to write about the mafia in the 1950s and 1960s, have at it. Look up Norman Rothman and securities. You can find a lot of stuff in the FBI files. But nevertheless, they're like, okay, I don't really know. Like, so there's like, there was some mafia like checking out of Castro. And like the mafia were like, well, we don't, like, nobody knew anything about this guy, really. They just knew that he wanted to overthrow Batista, but they didn't know he was like a leftist or anything like that.
Yeah.
And so people were like kind of trying to curry favor with him because Batista did not look like he was doing very well, especially by 1959. And so it's possible that these guns were meant to go to Castro because this robbery happens before Batista falls. I don't know. It also maybe is for people connected to Jose Alemán, who would have had a falling out with Castro a year after the revolution. He was like a Cuban political figure who will come up later on the JFK assassination. Based in Miami at this point, they could have been. Castro wasn't like, his group wasn't the only people that were fighting the Cuban government. There were other ones that may have had connections here too. But even if it did, you know, these weapons never got to him. On January 1st, 1959, Batista flees Cuba. Fidel Castro comes to power. The mafia has seemingly curried no favors, and he kicks them out. For unknown reasons, Norman Rothman moves to Dallas, Texas. He lists his occupation as public relations. A House Select Committee on Assassination report says this is when he first came to the CIA's attention. Batista's people, in large part, come to Miami, and there seem to be no hard feelings between them and the gangsters. Here's what one of Cappy's friends, in a quote from his autobiography, puts it.
It was an unusual situation because Cappy's father had a connection with the Batista people, and they took over a hotel in Miami Beach, the Biltmore Terrace Hotel, and they put on a show from the Tropicana Club from Cuba. They needed someone with a clean record to front the whole operation, so they put Cappy in as the manager of the hotel and the nightclub.
This is from a 1977 House Select Committee on Assassinations report.
An October 15, 1959 cable states that a new anti-Castro organization with headquarters in Miami at the Biltmore Terrace Hotel is managed by Norman Rothman, quote, who is supposed to produce through U.S. gangster guns and other weapons, unquote.
In 1959, Min Chu Chang, a Chinese-American scientist, successfully fertilizes a rabbit using in vitro fertilization. This is from an FBI report from 1959.
On December 10th, 1959, PSI James P. Dowrick confidentially advised Special Agent James Hayes that Rothman had told him that he was going to make a trip to Yucatan, Mexico, to locate a site for a base of operations in order to attempt to overthrow the Castro government in Cuba.
Rothman and associates purchased a B-26 aircraft. They might have gotten two of them. It's a little unclear. Rothman takes a contract from General Rafael Trujillo, the dictator of the Dominican Republic, to assassinate William Morgan, the American revolutionary in Cuba who was soon to be on the outs with Castro. He hangs out with Rolando Masferrer, the famous Cuban anti-guerrilla and torturer. Things get very complicated in his life. Grand juries are convened. Rothman goes to Frank Sturgis, saying he can get him MiGs from Czechoslovakia flown by Cuban pilots. And he's been hanging around a lot with two members of Cuba's former aviation bureaus, both military and civilian. John F. Kennedy is elected president of the United States in November 1960. And Norman Rothman goes to prison for 5 years. The disastrous Bay of Pigs invasion, where CIA-backed Cuban exiles land on a beach in Cuba and are shot to pieces by members of the heroic Cuban military, happens in 1961. Cappy Rothman, in his autobiography titled God of Sperm, comments on it.
Look, I had been in ROTC in college. I had been to Ranger training. I was an expert in most of the weaponry of the day. I was young, healthy, had a lot of testosterone running around, and it seemed exciting, says Cappy. I knew many Cubans, and I was interested in going. But for some reason, I was kept from going. I'm not sure if it was because I was in ROTC or because my father wanted to restrain me, but I know I wasn't able to go with them, and ultimately, I was very happy I wasn't able to go with them.
John F. Kennedy is blamed for the failure of the Bay of Pigs invasion. Many people in the CIA, the Mafia, Cuban exile groups are angry with him. His head is blown off in Dallas on November 22, 1963. Jose Alamein, that guy I mentioned earlier who possibly had these connections with Rothman, tells the FBI that Santos Traficante told him there was going to be a hit on JFK. He said JFK was going too hard on Hoffa and his friends. Cappy Rothman gets a job with Jimmy Hoffa, working in D.C. with him and the Teamsters. He's introduced to Jimmy Hoffa by his father, Norman Rothman. But Cappy gets drafted and finagles his way into the Coast Guard and to medical training. He loves it. He says, Jimmy Hoffa, I can't be hanging around with you anymore. You're too crazy for me. This lifestyle that you guys want to live, I can't live it with you guys. I have been introduced via the Coast Guard to the amazing possibilities contained in the human body. And through his later journeys, Cappy Rothman will enter into a world of knowledge and understanding unknown to any of these Dutchmen or these Germans or these Greek philosophers or Onan or Judah or God himself. Cappy Rothman will discover how to make life after death. All right, ladies and gentlemen. We will see you for part two next week, or whatever, actually next episode.
In the future.
I don't know what time this... In the future. I don't know why I said next week so confidently. My name is Brace Belden.
I'm producer Young Chomsky.
I'm Liz, and this has been True Anon. We will see you next time. Bye-bye.